You're listening to the Mythgreen Podcast with your hosts, Oren Ashkenazi, Wes Matlock, and Chris Winkle. There was a castle by a waterfall with a pink and purple wall and a princess living there. She had no parents and was all alone. She got by on her own and she liked it pretty well. Cause she never wore socks. She had a pet snake. She bought a red guitar and she ate a whole cake. And there wasn't anybody there. Tell her what to do, so she did what she wanted to. Everybody knew the story of the princess who saved herself.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Mythgreen Podcast. I'm your host, Wes, and with me today is...
Chris.
And...
Oren.
And today we're talking about developing stronger characters, and no, not a fitness regimen. We're talking about having to create characters that your readers will want to invest in, characters who are well-developed and, you know, like believable, realistic to the point where they kind of come to life in your stories. And that's really hard, like super hard. So today we're hoping to break down a lot of what we think is practical advice, some steps, some general commentary, and hopefully we'll get super buff, awesome, stronger characters.
You like strong characters? How basic. I like my characters to be deep and conflicted and complex.
I do realize that saying a strong character is like saying like, oh, that movie was good or interesting, you know?
That is a confusing thing about this phrase, strong characters, or because it's, if it means good, why do we keep using the word strong all the time?
Yeah, I kind of thought maybe like strong, like a strong character was maybe meant to be like, I want to say it's like synonymous with like forceful or like tangible or like it has a force to it. Yeah, I don't know, like something to mean real, but it's fictional.
A shorthand for saying they make a strong impression.
Maybe that's it. That's better. Yeah.
Maybe you get, they have a strong feel.
I was actually about to suggest that. I think that it's, in this context, it means that the character is strong in that they leave an impression on you and you remember them. You know, I think that's generally what it means. It's a little vague, right? It means other things, but that's like its most important feature. In different contexts, it means different things. When you talk about strong female characters, it means agency. It means something completely different when you say that. Learn context is all I can say.
Well, I think at this point, even though that might have been its original origins, it's used for pretty much anything to the point where it just means good character. And so then you have to define what a strong character is in many cases, because otherwise, if you don't, how do people know what they're looking for, right? How do they know whether their character is strong or not and if they've gotten there?
And so a good way to maybe approach that is like, well, if you're looking at a character and you're like, well, what is that character's like narrative purpose? And you don't know. That's not a good sign. Like, what is that character doing in this story? What's that character's like role? And if that's not clearly well defined, that's going to be an issue and it's going to be difficult for that character, other than maybe it, you know, leaving a strong impression of your mind as that weird character that didn't fit in anywhere. And, you know, like run through your list, the protagonist, antagonist, sidekick, mentor, love interest, like.
You forgot deuteragonist.
Oh no, how could I?
Always remember the deuteragonist.
No.
Just no.
For anyone who doesn't know what deuteragonist means, it means secondary protagonist. It's like, you know, you're a secondary character. Very often you will have more than one, and you can call them the deuteragonists.
Do they just make like duty quips? Or...
Yeah, that's what they do.
I love it and hate it.
I always just say either the protagonist for the main character or protagonists for all the characters you're supposed to root for. It seems to work okay. No, but at least nobody has told me they're confused in the comments.
I think it makes sense. And, you know, it allows you to kind of like, when we talk about these stories, you know, you're not saying sidekick is a little pejorative almost. And some people really like the secondary protagonist or whatever you want to call it and will be, you know, like... You don't want to like hurt anybody's feelings or anything about a character they love. If you're a Robin fan, that's fine. Like, Batman gets enough love.
Right. Although Robin is explicitly a sidekick, whereas when we get out of the side of the superhero genre, a lot of secondary characters, they don't feel like sidekicks are not in the same genre. So, yeah, that just starts to get weirder.
My favorite is when some people assume that because one character is better or, like, more developed in some way, they must actually be the main character. I've seen multiple YouTube videos purporting to explain how Zuko is the main character of Avatar.
Really?
And it's like, no, he's not. He's the best character of Avatar, you know, maybe with Toph as an exception. He's certainly a better character than Aang. But that he's not the main character. That does not has nothing to do with his quality level. That's just not the role he plays in the story.
No, yeah. Yeah, he's so important to the story, but like the main like through line of this story doesn't necessarily depend on Zuko's character arc. It's Aang. That's so I'm upset, Oren, that people like that argued that.
I did not love it either when I first saw it. I was like, I get it, guys. I get that it's a little disappointing that Aang's kind of the weakest character on Team Avatar, but we just have to accept it.
Right. By the same criteria, Katniss is a chosen one.
Oh,
Sorry, I had to bring that up. That's been driving Oren up the wall for a
while. Yeah, I keep seeing like articles and videos talking about chosen ones using Katniss as an example, and it's like, Katniss doesn't meet that criteria unless you're making your criteria so broad that any protagonist would count as a chosen one. And it's just, it's ridiculous. I hate it. Anyway, moving on.
Okay, so should we talk more about things that are part of being strong for a character?
What goes into helping make your character stronger, Chris Evans-esque?
Yeah, like, they gotta take like a special serum, I think. And then they can actually look like Chris Evans looks. No, okay, so my first thing that I always recommend people think about is motivation. This is certainly not the only thing that contributes to making characters do good, but it is very important, and I kind of think of it as a foundation. And if your motivation is bad, very often, even if you have a lot of cool things on top of it, it won't matter, you know, because this is my foundation metaphor. Your character will come tumbling down, and then you'll have to make a big insurance payout. It'll be bad.
It makes sense because, you know, tension and conflict will happen. So, like, what's going to get them through that?
You know, why is the character doing what they're doing? Is a surprisingly simple question that stories often fail. Like, either they don't know why the character is doing what they're doing, or the reasons are bad. That's a fun one. Like, Or it doesn't really matter, or what the character's doing isn't really that important. You know, these are all things that can make your character feel weak, or not good, or boring, not engaging, all the various...
Nonsensical. And this is especially a big deal with villains, who just do, like, you know, well, they're a villain. And it's like, okay, but, like, why did they just kill that minion? That minion was actually important to their efforts. They've made themselves weaker and less likely to defeat the hero. That kind of thing. Like, why did the villain just do that? But they're a villain. They have to, you know, cackle and kick puppies.
Or, like, why do they want to blow up the Earth? They live on the Earth.
That's another one.
You know, why are they selling their shrink tech to a terrorist organization when they could be selling it to the U.S. military for way more money? You know, like, there's just the questions like that, right? When it comes to good guys, you usually want motivations to be things like, you know, think about, like, how big a difference is it going to make if they succeed at what they're trying to do, and, like, who will be affected, and how achievable is it? These are all important. Because, generally speaking, you want your protagonist to have a motivation that will help people other than themselves. Not always, there are exceptions. But having your protagonist want to help other people is just a shortcut to getting your audience invested in them.
And you can really flesh that out too, like, you know, wanting them to help other people. That's great. And if you spend some time with your characters, like, maybe just defining, like, okay, well, what is their, like, everyday reality like? You know, how do they go about their days? What do they believe? Who do they associate with? And then your, you know, inciting incident happens, and then their motivation kicks in, and suddenly it's like, okay, like, I know how they would behave because I've kind of thought out about their relationships. They're not just wanting to help people because of this. They're wanting to help people because of this, that, and of course that thing that happened. Not all of that, of course, needs to go into the story. We don't need massive exposition dumps, but they can really inform choices when you do that kind of background work for yourself.
Yeah, some people really like to do that. They like build character sheets for the protagonist. And if it helps you, I say go for it. In my experience, there is a danger that if you write all that stuff down, you will end up forgetting that your reader might not know the character as well as you do. So that's a risk. Not saying you shouldn't do it. Just, like, be aware. If you have, like, huge backstories written down for your character that aren't in the story, there's a good chance that things your character does will seem obvious to you, and your reader will be like, I don't understand why they just did that thing they did.
Have you ever had, when, like, you guys, like, worked on manuscripts, like, had an author say, like, you know, I have my reference material for my characters if you need it, or something like that?
Yeah, sometimes. Usually what I make them do is, instead of, like, sending me their world-building file, which has all of their characters' backstory, I usually get this stuff by asking them questions and making them type out answers so that they have to be concise. Because if they want me to read 10 pages of character backstory, that costs extra. It's like they have to pay me for that.
Yep.
Yeah. And, you know, writers don't want to pay lots of more money for their edit. So we gotta keep things efficient.
Right, and usually there's no reason to. Usually it turns out they can explain these things in a few sentences. They don't usually need 10 pages of backstory.
One thing I like to keep in mind when it comes to creating characters is that it's not just protagonists that need to be created. Minor characters do too. And so with minor characters, it's a big question of, you know, how much we can get with both the little time that they have on screen, but also it's not as efficient, you know, to spend lots of time writing all of the backstory for all of your minor characters. Especially since, once again, if we have that problem where they're overly complex and they don't have the screen time to explain it, that could be an issue. So looking at, you know, there's a difference between what all characters need to have, regardless of their role in the story, and what important characters need to have, or it's better if they have, and what protagonists should have. So I guess the next thing that may seem kind of obvious, but is still something to think about for all characters, is simply some level of distinctiveness. In fact, it's almost this is almost most optional for the protagonist, strangely enough. But that just means that they have characteristics that stand out from other people so that they make a strong impression, and also it makes it easier to tell them apart, especially if you have lots of characters, which hopefully you're taking out characters that aren't necessary and keeping that number down. But when you do have larger groups, having a character that is distinct from other characters, it adds to the novelty of the character. It makes the character more entertaining.
Yeah, and, like, you don't want your character to be like a one-note stereotype, but at the same time, they do need to be distinctive enough that you can remember them.
Well, okay, about that, though.
Oh, yeah?
So how one-note they can be is dependent on their screen time. Okay, so a character that has very little screen time, it's actually okay if they're one-note.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Because you have no time to get to know them. But once again, once we get to important characters, they need, what I was going to say is, they need complexity, right? But really minor characters, you know, if you have a short scene and they play a really small role and you don't have lots of time to get to know them, just being distinctive is enough. There is, of course, if you just use boring stereotypes to do that, you know, do you really want a scene with, like, the big, gruff, muscly motorcycle dude? Yeah, okay, you can make a character stand out that way, but there's something that's also just inherently uninteresting about that, because we've all seen the big, gruff, muscly motorcycle dude character in all of these stories, you know, glowering at the hero.
This is why if you have a big, buff, muscly motorcycle man, you should make him into knitting.
Yes.
Or something like that. I mean, it sounds like a joke, but it's not.
He could learn macrame, and then you'd have, like, cool, like, bag containers to sling over his shoulders while he's riding his motorcycle for carrying goods.
Yeah, yeah. I think we have a new post-apocalyptic hero.
Oh my gosh, yes.
This is going to be Mad Max in the next Mad Max movie.
Yeah, but the macrame motorcyclist.
Yeah! I would also just say real quick, this is a little bit beyond characters, but distinctiveness also applies to things like factions or groups within your story. Because if you have a conflict between groups and I can't remember which is which, that's not a good sign. I just read Red Rising and watched Record of Grandcrest, both of which are about faction conflicts, and I could not remember which faction was doing what at any one, because they're all the same. They have no distinctive characteristics at all.
A character that came to mind while we were talking about distinction that's a minor character that we covered on the Memory Called Empire podcast. Unfortunately, her name escapes me, but it's the doctor surgeon that they go visit when Mahit needs to get the imago removed from her head. And that was cool because earlier in the book, they'd really established that the Teixkalani, they like tech and they have their kind of internet that operates through a monocle or whatever. But Mahit has got a cerebral implant. And apparently the Teixkalani look down on that. But then when Mahit needs hers removed, they find this like underground surgeon. And when she appears, she has like cybernetic augmentation and she's willing to do this. And then it just like, it hints at something a lot more. Like there's a whole lot of novelty because of what had been established earlier and her presence and kind of just like loose association that we have hints at this faction that's like not really explored in the book, but it just... It gave me a taste of an even bigger city and a more complicated like nation.
Yeah, although I would say that that character also represents a kind of risk in that book we see that no one in Teixkalan has these kind of implants, and then they're like, okay, we need someone in Teixkalan to be able to do like emergency surgery on this brain implant that no one in Teixkalan knows how to do, and it's like, don't worry, I know a guy. And, right, and yeah. Then we just go to her and it's like, wow, you're weird and different. What about, that sounds interesting. Can we follow you? No, she's not part of the story.
I know. And like, you could try to hand wave that by saying like, oh, well, you know, Mahit and Three Seagrass, they're like just hanging out with the elites and they're out of touch, but it wasn't in the book. So, you know, like your point stands.
And like, I'm not sure if this character qualifies, but it is possible to make a background character too interesting. And like, yeah, you know, okay, that character either feels out of place, or especially if I'm a little bored with what's happening, I'll be like, can we follow that character, please? You know, it's like if you're watching a post-apocalyptic movie, and then just like, in the background, someone rides by on a dog sled, and you're like, wait, what? Hang on. And like, it's not like it's impossible to explain why there's a guy on a dog sled in a post-apocalyptic Mad Max movie. But it would seem kind of weird, right?
Okay, we're definitely getting back to the Crow Eaters in Mad Max Fury Road.
Look, I wasn't going to say it, okay?
We had a big discussion previously on the podcast about these Crow Eaters.
Yeah, I will die on that Crow Eater hill.
I can't help it. I love the Crow Eaters. I don't want them to go anywhere.
Yeah, they don't make sense. They're bad. They should have been cut from the movie.
I mean, this is the give and take of putting something in your story that has a lot of novelty, but is also kind of distracting from the story. It's like, yes, that could be lots of fun for some people. It could also be distracting.
It was very distracting. I was just sitting there being like, why are they there? What do they eat? What is happening? I don't get it. Why are the crows? If they eat the crows, what do the crows eat? What? Look, I have questions, okay? I have crow questions.
So many questions.
Another thing that can be helpful, and this is specifically for main characters, characters who you're going to spend a lot of time with, is to think about their kind of more complex desires. Because you have your motivation, which is sort of your overriding, like, this is what the character is doing and why they're doing it. But the character can want more than one thing. So, you know, you might have a character whose motivation is to save this kingdom from falling. But they also want to earn their mother's approval, right? And if you want to get real spicy, you can have conflicting desires of like, you know, where it's like, well, my motivation is to save the kingdom from falling, but like the enemy general is my ex and I want them to think I'm cool so we can get back together. Or something like that, right? And that can make for a fun, memorable, dare I say, strong character.
Dare you. I think maybe one more level to that could be what a character needs also. You can have complex desires and the character can have... I think about this more in terms of growth arcs where a character has a desire and motivation, but what the character maybe needs is not like the approval of an outside figure, but like comes to realize that what the character needed was to, you know, like love herself or something, you know, something like that. So like needs, desires, goals, motivations. There's a lot of layers to that.
Right. You know, you could be real tricky and have the character be like, you know, I desire approval or I desire validation, and then like reveal that actually what they needed was self-esteem, you know, that sort of thing.
Consistency.
Ugh, yes, praise, yes.
Gosh, so I'm getting very basic, but, and I think a lack of consistency in many cases is caused by problems in other areas. Like, if we don't know what their motivation is, it's much harder to have them act in a consistent manner. If you don't have a good feel for those traits that make them distinctive, you know, you haven't quite made up your mind about what kind of person this character is yet, they're a lot more likely to be inconsistent. Or sometimes we see some situations where it feels like the character hasn't really just been thought through, that they're there to fill some other role. My Dawn of Wonder critique, Dawn of Wonder, The Awakening.
The Awakening, oh no.
We have this character in there, and Kelry, I think is her name, and she is watching this scene where basically bullying is happening. The main character is bullying a side character, it's great. And she's alternately disapproving but also laughing. And it's not like you can't have those different things in there, right? But it's clear in this situation that the writer just wanted her to be the audience and was just projecting that onto her and not really thinking of her for herself, right? And what she was thinking. And I think that was the problem in that situation. And it's not that you can't have characters who have contradictory ideas or sometimes exhibit contradictory behavior. It's more that if they do change their behavior or contradict themselves, the audience needs to understand why. And if there's no explanation there, it just looks inconsistent.
Inconsistency also often arrives when you haven't ironed out conflicts between the character's motivation and the plot that you want. And sometimes this is because you have two, you know, a perfectly reasonable motivation and a perfectly reasonable plot, but they just don't match and you don't ever resolve that difference. And that's what happens at Game of Thrones. It's perfectly reasonable for the story to end with Daenerys killing a bunch of people. They just didn't do the work to make that in her interests, to make her in a situation where she would want to do that. And then it can also just be the sign of a very bad plot. Like, that's what happens in Merlin, where the plot is that we need to keep Uther alive, and Uther is magic Hitler, and he murders babies. And it's like, there's no way that's gonna be good. There's no way you can make a character we would like who would want that character to stay on the throne. And as a result, Merlin, it's like he has no reason to want to help Uther, but he just does because the story needs him to. And then Merlin starts to feel incredibly inconsistent because of that.
I would also say on Uther's end, Uther is amazingly inconsistent. And it's right. And it's because, for instance, oh, what's the actor's name?
Anthony Stewart Head.
Yeah. So we've got this great actor who played Giles in Buffy the Vampire Slayer playing this character. And he's the king, and because he's powerful, he's put in a position where, okay, he has to be an antagonistic most of the time so that we have enough conflict for the episode. So whenever the character's like, hey, we think there's a troll causing trouble, he's like, no, I don't believe you. You know? Like, anything good, anytime the characters want to do something good, he has to oppose it in order to create conflict, right? Which means that he just constantly makes bad decisions. But then they also need to justify why they have to keep him around. So then they tried to oscillate back towards like, no, he's like a really, you know, noble guy, and he's actually good for Camelot, despite having murdered children. We have it is canonically established that he killed mage children. We don't know how.
He drowned them, actually. They do establish that.
Well, okay, no, but I mean, like, the idea that he committed magical genocide, he doesn't have the power to do that.
Right, that's impossible.
Yes, but we did establish he drowned those mage children. It's true. That's how canonical this is. We even know details. But then, so he oscillates back and forth. Janeway in Voyager has a similar issue.
Mm-hmm.
Again, she's also in a position of authority where she just makes whatever decision is necessary to make the plot move forward. And a lot of times she has to, you know, oppose things that would allow them to go home. Other times she has to do things that, you know, no, we want to do this so we can go home. And so it's just all over the place.
Right. That's where you get the weird thing where one week Janeway will be like, well, no, of course we're not going to break Starfleet regulations in like any possible way because, you know, if we did, we would easily get out of trouble, and the writers need the characters to be in trouble. And then the next week, it's like, yeah, we're going to break Starfleet regulations and charge right through this dangerous aliens territory. Because if we didn't, the characters wouldn't be in trouble, and the writers need the characters to be in trouble.
How about candy and spinach for characters? How does this affect their ability to leave a stronger impression on us? Because I think over-candied ones are forgettable.
I mean, or you might remember them for the wrong reason.
Yeah, also that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, having the right balance of candy and spinach will make them more memorable in that you will like them more, right? Like, with candy, you will be like, yeah, this is a character that I enjoy reading about. And with spinach, you'll be like, yeah, this character has identifiable problems that, like, make me cheer for them, right? And, yeah, those two things are a good way to make a very strong character.
Yeah, they're mostly ways of managing likability. And I do think that there might be a sense that there's a lot of main characters that have too much candy. And mm-hmm. I do also think that sometimes if you want your main character to be perfect, that might keep you from doing things that make the character interesting, right? If you don't allow the... Especially if you've got a big budget story in Hollywood and they have to, like, Hollywood central casting. I keep thinking of this show about that's supposed to be about the Lady of the Lake that's on Netflix right now. And the main character is just very kind of stoic. Like, it feels like they want to make her a strong character by making her not like other girls. And the other girls in their mind is, like, having emotions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she's, like, Hollywood central casting in that we've got, like, the typical, like, beautiful look to her with, like, straight blonde hair and everything. And she has, you know, a best friend that is just way more interesting than she is. And the actress is allowed to be so much more expressive, right? And she has a lot of, you know, jokey and teasiness to her, and she looks more distinctive. And I think that's because they do not think that she had to be perfect.
I've also just come to the conclusion that a lot of actors and directors have trouble with stoic characters. Like, you can make a stoic character that's interesting, but I think it must just take a high level of skill, because very often they just come across as boring. Like, I can think of two examples off the top of my head. The dad from Supernatural, Sam and Dean's dad, like, when he's just being his normal stoic self, he's very boring. And then he gets possessed by a demon, and suddenly the actor just comes alive and is emoting and is scary and intimidating. And I'm like, wow, this is a good bad guy. I'm sad that this demon doesn't possess this character forever, because this guy's great. He was made for this role. And then the same thing happened in Babylon 5 with the character of not Sheridan, the one before Sheridan. I've forgotten his name. But the first commander, Commander Monotone, I call him, because he is a monotone. I thought he couldn't act. I was like, is this guy just not a good actor? And then in one episode, he, like, pretends to be a mob boss. And suddenly, again, he just comes alive and has mannerisms and charisma. And I was like, okay, I think it's just that you're having a hard time with him being super stoic. I think is what's happening here.
I do think with Supernatural, part of the issue is that their dad has some characteristics and certainly has flaws. At the same time, it feels like when he walks in the room, they want him to, like, embody dad. Embody the father that young men are supposed to admire. And it's also not just the stoicness, which is a masculine thing that's probably part of it, but that perfection, that idea of perfection, that he can't be a normal person. He has to be some some greater than human dad figure.
So we are kind of running low on time, but I do want to talk about something that is useful, but must be handled carefully, and that is backstory. And this can be very useful for making your characters more memorable, making them feel more alive, but it's also dangerous. Handle with care, because a little backstory goes a long way. But with backstory, you can have things like, you know, bring up old relationships, you can have unfinished business, you can have places that matter to the character because things happened there. And this, you know, makes the character feel alive. It makes them feel like they existed before the story started. And that's very useful. But at the same time, their audiences have a pretty limited amount of backstory they're willing to absorb.
You got to dole that out, like, as they're adventuring or doing stuff, right? Like, you know, if the character behaves some way, maybe it's because, you know, like, she's haunted by something in her past. Literally, this ghost keeps following her around.
Usually, audiences will care about backstory if it is relevant to the plot. And that's usually the way to introduce it. The two examples that come to mind are Mahit from Memory Cult Empire, who is literally investigating her previous self. And that's a little bit of a cheat because we're using special technology to let her do that. But, you know, it works. And then Dresden from the Dresden Files has this very complicated backstory. But all it really tells us at the beginning is that, like, we get a little bit to explain why he's in this very precarious situation. And then, you know, we learn more as it becomes relevant to the plot. His, like, you know, as we find out that he killed his old mentor when that action comes back to haunt him and stuff like that, right?
Just as another thing, you do have to share the backstory if you want it to have an emotional effect. I just need to make this clear because if you have a character that, for instance, their estranged mother or their old best friend that's now an enemy walks into the room, right? If you don't share any details about their history and your character is like getting really upset about this character, it's the audience isn't going to feel it without some of that context. So sharing the backstory, often in exposition, you don't usually have to go into full flashback scenes with this. You just have to give enough evocative details to make it clear, like, why was this best friend important to the main character? But you do have to give that information out if you want the audience to feel like it means something, that they're there. Otherwise, the protagonist feels something, the audience doesn't, and we usually want them to feel it together. So, again, we don't want too much backstory, but we do need some.
That's a good point, Chris, and we've covered just quite a lot of ground, actually. You know, we talked about, for developing stronger characters, got to figure out what the heck that character is doing in your story, their role, their narrative purpose. They need to be distinct. So, you know, their flaws, maybe their quirks, their beliefs, their worldviews. Most importantly, they need to have motivation and agency that goes along with that. A healthy mix of candy and spinach. And don't forget that, like, all the characters need to have their own stories kind of defined within the story. Like Zuko, we mentioned, has an incredibly well-defined story, but his story is not the main story. It's an excellent example, though, of like a really well-thought-out, very strong character who is not the main character of The Last Airbender.
Gotta make sure to put that in there.
Yep.
All right, well, I think that will be it for this episode. Those of you at home, anything we said piqued your interest, you can leave a comment on the website at mythgrants.com. Except if you want to argue with us about if Zuko is the main character. I don't have time. Before we go, I want to thank a few of our patrons. First, we have Kathy Ferguson, who's a professor of political theory in Star Trek. Next, we have Amon Jobber. He's an urban fantasy writer and a connoisseur of Marvel. And finally, we have Danita Rambo. She lives at therambogeeks.com. We'll talk to you next week.
If you're stuck on your next draft, we'd love to help. We offer consulting and editing services on mythcreants.com. There was a dragon with a pointy tail. He was bigger than a whale, and his breath was terrible. He scared the princess when he came around. Tried to burn the castle down, but she caught him by his tail. Then she tied him to a tree so the dragon couldn't fly. She told him he was mean.
This has been the Mythgreant Podcast, opening closing theme, The Princess Who Saved Herself, by Jonathan Coulton.